Ken.
Hi, Kayla. Hi, Linda.
This is Kayla Price and Linda Hopache for New Books in Anthropology.
Today, we are talking to Ken McLeish, our graduate school colleague and assistant professor of medicine, health, and society at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about his new book, Making War at Fort Hood, Life and Uncertainty in a Military Community, published by Princeton University Press. It's an ethnography of the everyday lives of people who are involved in the production of war. Tell us a little bit about your personal background and how you became involved in anthropology.
Sure. So I think I got infected by social science in my undergrad years at Bard College. It's a pretty small liberal arts college in the Northeast in the Hudson Valley, just a ways north of New York City. And I was actually a sociology major, and I left undergrad thinking that I wanted to go to grad school and thinking that I probably wanted to pursue a career in academia. And it was largely because I liked the way that reading social theory changed the way the world looked to me. That there were these sort of these explanations for things and these ways of seeing the world critically that, far from being kind of like alienating or confusing, actually helped the world make a lot more sense to me. And so I think by a decent ways through undergrad, thanks in no small part to a lot of the wonderful teachers I had in those years, I knew that this kind of thought was something that that just felt like really valuable and productive activity to me, and something that that I was at least minimally good at. In a way that that I wasn't necessarily so skilled in other areas. I've sometimes found myself saying that I think I ended up being an anthropologist because I was concerned about and interested in political problems out in the world, but I realized I wasn't very good at being a political activist, and I wasn't sure that I could do that great of a job at being a journalist. But in the kind of scholarly inquiry that's grounded in real world experience that you get to do in anthropology, I felt like I really found a home and sort of found some traction. I suppose saying it that way makes it sound as though anthropology is sort of a poor substitute for those other areas, which is certainly not at all the way I think about it. I actually think about it, as I hope all of us do, as, its own kind of particular critical knowledge that has a real role to play in the broader public sphere, and I hope that's something that at least some sense of that comes through in the book.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the subject?
Sure. Yeah. So I had been interested for a long time, again, sort of starting in my undergrad years, in kind of questions and problems of legitimate violence and what kinds of violence was okay and what kinds of violence were okay and what kinds were not, what sorts of value was attached to violence when it was sort of practiced or exercised in different domains. And war, in a way, is sort of an ultimate test case for that, in to the extent that it is defined by the licensed production of violence, the licensed production of these kinds of acts that under all other circumstances would be illegal. But that in the instance of war waged by states, sort of takes on actually the and kind of literally embodies and materializes right and reason and law, and gives those things sort of material substance, often in the form of terrible destruction, the fact that contradiction is so sort of so intense and so poignant, and yet we have all these kind of cultural narratives for sort of talking past it or talking around it in various ways. And that problem is something that's been interesting to me, just sort of, you know, since I started thinking about social science and reading social theory, and not least because I was involved in some anti-war organizing and activism in my undergrad years, and then also, you know, graduated college right into the very beginning of the war on terror in 2001, and also sort of around that time felt increasingly sort of confused and kind of frustrated by the language that was available to talk about war, whether in terms of kind of substantive public debate or as active critique. The fact that that discussions about war and what the exercise of military violence meant, especially as they were playing out in the early 2000s, just seems so sort of bound by all of these cultural, these sort of standard cultural common sense frames about organized violence. Like the idea that war is somehow automatically about something, and that the experiences and practices that make it up are automatically meaningful in these sort of cliched and expected ways that we're all kind of used to hearing about. And one of the things that I felt like was missing from those discussions was some perspective on what it is that the actual activities of war consist of for the people who live with them firsthand, and the people who are actively involved in producing them firsthand, and whether this be civilians living in the midst of war zones, or whether it be informal combatants or professional combatants, as might be the case, and this was particularly interesting to me, I think, because of a lot of the rhetoric that again was sort of there floating around in the public sphere in the early 2000s, whether it was pro-war, anti-war rhetoric, the role that that this figure of the troops seemed to play, and the imperative to for one thing, sort of the political imperative to support the troops no matter what, but to not necessarily sort of delve in any curious or critical sense to the questions of what it is, what activities and practices actually sort of define the lives of these troops in the name of whom all these various political claims are being made. And one of the things that helped me think about that a lot was just reading military memoir, which is something that I had also gotten interested in undergrad and found myself kind of coming back to again over those periods of time too, and thinking of works like Michael Herr's Dispatches, or Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, or Anthony Swofford's Jarhead, and a lot of others. Accounts that aren't even necessarily particularly pro-war, anti-war in their particular stance, but rather define this kind of realm of experience that is incredibly powerful and intense, but is often sort of isolated from or insulated from the more kind of conventional public discourses about war. These ideas of what war is about in some straightforward sense, and so that disconnect between the actual activities that make up the practice of war and the ways that we talk about it and the stories we tell about it, that tension was just seemed like an increasingly interesting and significant problem to me, and something that I wanted to spend more time thinking about.
And so how did you come to write this particular book?
I was fortunate in that this was the project that I was thinking I wanted to do when I got to grad school. And so fortunate in the sense that it turned out to be viable and I didn't get burned out on it and I didn't have to radically reformulate it in the middle and all that stuff. Really too, I feel incredibly fortunate that it is still something that that interests me a lot and that I anticipate sort of occupying my interest for a long time to come. For various reasons, I ended up at UT Austin for graduate school, and it was really fortuitous in many ways. Not the least of which was the fact that in Austin, I was essentially right down the road from Fort Hood, which is as I imagine you already knew, but like I described in at some length in the book too, is this place it's one of the largest military installations in the country, and it's one of the busiest and most important points of deployment for U.S. forces, actually in all sorts of locations overseas, but for the wars in Afghanistan, and especially the war in Iraq when it was ongoing. Huge amount of soldiers from the unit stationed there deployed regularly to Iraq, and then National Guard and Reserve units also would come, and as they still do, from all over the country for extensive pre-deployment training at Fort Hood before going to Iraq or Afghanistan or Kuwait. I was really lucky to sort of have this location within easy reach, and that's a big part of what produced the book.
We'll start off with the prologue, which is provocatively entitled "Don't Fucking Leave Any of This Shit Out." Can you tell us what this means and how it came to shape your approach to telling about the lives of the people in Fort Hood?
Yeah, absolutely. This really is sort of a good place to start from. So I guess maybe I should explain for folks who haven't read the book that title is a quotation from a soldier who in the book I refer to as Dime, who was a tanker who served in Iraq as part of the did several deployments that his last one as part of the surge in 2006. And he related that line to me in the course of this sort of more general exhortation of frustration that he was feeling. He had survived being blown up by incredibly powerful IEDs several times. He had a whole complicated set of injuries that he was struggling with, including what are called barotraumatic injuries. These are orthopedic injuries that come from the force of blast waves from roadbed bomb explosions, and in addition to traumatic brain injury, which of course has these various sort of complicated neurological and cognitive problems that can really impede the function and experience of people who are afflicted with them, as was the case with Diamond. He had also been diagnosed with PTSD, and so as a result, he was he had been assigned to what's called a warrior transition unit at Fort Hood, which is essentially a sort of medically oriented holding company that soldiers are assigned to when they become too ill or injured to do their regular jobs. And they instead get assigned to this alternate unit so that an able-bodied person can take their place in their regular unit and be able to deploy. And in the meantime, their job is to essentially sort of maintain this rather busy schedule of going to the doctor and meeting with caseworkers and meeting with various different physicians and therapists and pharmacists and so on, and processing paperwork for, in Dime's case, discharge from the army, getting his injuries and afflictions attended to. But this is an incredibly sort of a complicated and bureaucratized and slow moving process, in large part simply just because of the nature of the institution. You know, nothing necessarily directly to do with the poor intentions of the folks who are directly involved with it, but simply a kind of chaotic and fragmented system that that Dime was in a position of moving very slowly through. And and this situation for him was the cause of tremendous frustration and distress. So sort of in addition to his physical injuries, which were, in their own terms, very difficult to live with and hard to diagnose and hard to recognize, hard for the doctors to figure out how to treat. In addition to his psychiatric diagnosis, which had, has these symptoms that that go with it that were tremendously disruptive to his kind of everyday experience. In addition to the circumstances in his personal life, he was his wife had divorced him and was living with his kids in another state, the sort of the loneliness and personal upheaval that that went along with that. In addition to all of those things, he sort of found himself in the middle of this like I said, kind of confusing and bureaucratic and fragmented system that was meant to care for him, meant to treat his injuries, meant to figure out how to compensate him and help provide him with livelihood once he left the military, but that it was in general just sort of a challenging and overwhelming experience that added a whole other sort of layer of stress and frustration to his life, and I think that. So talking to Dime, and this is just Dime's story in particular, and the way that he, the way that when we met and spoke, and the way that he laid all these various factors out, sort of in such close proximity to one another in our conversation, I felt for me really crystallized a sense of how it is that the impacts of war are these things that come from all sorts of different directions. You know, they don't just come from the enemy on the battlefield. In Dime's case, a big part of them came from there. But that there are all these other ways in which Dime was sort of rendered profoundly vulnerable to different forms of harm, different kinds of coercion, and also just sort of different forms of misunderstanding or misapprehension. And that all of these things, as he shared these stories with me, you know, as he sort of, you know, moved from sharing the story of his divorce to his PTSD and traumatic brain injury symptoms to stories of surviving IED strikes and seeing close friends die in Iraq, that all of these things sort of kind of stacked on top of one another as this tremendously complex constellation of effects of war, and that the sources of harm and distress that he was confronting, again, like I said, didn't just come from the battlefield, but came from the military institution itself and came from the way that Dime understood himself to be recognized or perhaps misrecognized by the broader world. And so that was... that was what I understood him to be communicating with this injunction: don't fucking leave any of this shit out. And that was what I wanted to try to communicate at the prologue. It's a claim that I also tried to make with an appropriate level of modesty too, of course, right? I mean, you know, we all, the book's only 200 pages long. there isn't room for everything in there. But also just sort of on a different level, the fact that, you know, that ethnography is always sort of a partial process, partial in the sense of its interests and its sympathies, but also partial in the sense of you know, what it is that it's able to include, or its aspirations to comprehensiveness. But what I took from that from Don's exhortation was this sense of don't leave out anything that I understand to be important to my experience. You know, keep all of this stuff in here, keep all of it in view, make all of it part of the story of what war is about. And that really is what I've tried to do with the book.
If you could perhaps take us through chapter by chapter and really give us a sense of how you were thinking about structuring the book and your conceptual arguments.
Sure, absolutely. One thing I should say is that I didn't think of or conceive of the chapters in the order in which they appear. And I felt like in a way writing the dissertation and then sort of writing the book from it, or producing the book from it, was an exercise in the ethnographic project of kind of making your object by writing about it. You know, you just sort of, you start writing, you see what comes out, and eventually you have you don't just describe, but you also kind of discover the shape of an object through doing that. Many of the chapters are there because they represent ideas that just seemed persistently striking to me throughout the course of the fieldwork, and or sort of arose in different ways at different times. But as I put them together, I started to think of kind of what I wanted the overarching logic to be. So like it talks a bit about in the introduction, the notion of vulnerability became incredibly important to how I was thinking about a lot of the experiences that folks were relating to me. And it's an idea that I take from Judith Butler, from her work in Precarious Life and Frames of War, talking about just as a way of talking about both embodied and collective human experience in relation to structures of power, and the fact that that vulnerability is something that characterizes a whole lot of political experience, characterizes it at the bodily level, at the collective and interpersonal level, in the ways that that vulnerability is both sort of mitigated and accentuated through attachments between persons and within groups, and then also sort of at the level of recognition and representation, and again being sort of vulnerable to misrecognition or to misunderstanding, or even to the extent of how the value of one's life is understood. And so I really liked the way that this concept sort of brought together these bodily and social and representational and political registers in this really sort of concentrated way, and provided such a great vocabulary for talking about the relationship between those different registers, sometimes without even necessarily having to distinguish between them. And so I realized as I was working that a lot of the different things I was interested in, whether it was the question of, you know, what was the significance, you know, how was it that soldiers responded to civilians saying to them, thank you for your service, or, what's going on for soldiers when they talk about the potential, frailties and weaknesses of their armor and equipment, what's going on in folks' experiences when they talk about being at home while a loved one is at war and sort of living in fear of hearing the phone ring or of hearing a knock on the door that's going to bring news of harm or death. And so vulnerability was a thread that really sort of helped connect all of the kinds of experiences and phenomena. And so so as I was trying to figure out how all these parts came together, I think what I sort of ended up with is a structure of the chapters or of the ethnographic chapters. Sort of once we get past the some of the background material and kind of setting the scene at Fort Hood, is this sort of these chapters are arranged in a way that kind of arcs through these various different levels and registers of vulnerability, and kind of beginning in chapter two with the discussion of the actual sensory and embodied experiences of deployment, including these questions about armor and equipment, but also heat and weight and exhaustion and embodied tension and fear and vigilance. So starting with those things, with those forms of vulnerability that are sort of most directly associated with the firsthand practice of making war in a combat zone. Starting with those things, then in the next chapter, kind of moving on to what some of those bodily and affective impacts look like on the home front, as it were. Looking at, on the one hand, the interaction of soldiers with military medical with the military medical apparatus in terms of diagnosis of a physical injury and psychiatric injury, and ways that that these sort of directly embodied vulnerabilities are multiplied and given new meaning and assigned new significance upon their interaction with these sort of biopolitical schemes that are meant to kind of manage and care for them. But you know, as I discuss, also looking at the ways that those mechanisms of care and management also sort of potentially produce new forms of harm and new forms of vulnerability in the course of their work. And then also sort of on the interpersonal register, looking at ways that that vulnerability sort of extends beyond individual bodies, not just into institutions, but also into intimate relationships in terms of the communication and the sort of the way that the vulnerability of the soldier's body abroad in the war zone extends back to the home front, to this sort of affective and experiential vulnerability of those people who are close to soldiers. So that's sort of moving from the battlefield and then into these kind of more directly embodied modes that are sort of there on the home front, and that were very prominent in the conversations that I had with people and seemed to occupy a lot of their attention. And then moving in a way, sort of moving outward from those immediate bodily registers in the next two chapters to talk about some of the broader frames in which this vulnerability took shape. So first in the chapter on love, looking at these incredibly affirmative forms of attachment that people expressed both with one another, expressed in both in their attachments to the institution of the military itself and to their fellow soldiers, but also also to their families and kin, and how the idioms of each of these modes of attachment kind of bled into one another, and that they sometimes represented competing forms of attention or attachment, and sometimes overlapped with one another, sometimes interacted in strange or uncanny ways. But sort of exploring in that chapter the notion of vulnerability as a kind of as something that dwells in intimate relationships and various forms of intimacy, both within and outside of kind of conventional kin intimacy. And then in the final chapter, looking at this question of sort of recognition, the kinds of value that's assigned to life or to life endangering labor, and the idea that this constitutes a form of vulnerability as well, that the soldier's potentially mortal embodied labor is something that is necessarily translated into various ideas of kind of cultural and political value, and translated in very literal ways into material value in the form of wages and compensation and things like that. And here, sort of coming back to that rhetoric of supporting the troops and the idea of the soldier as this kind of this figure that's sort of so laden with associations and meanings and a repository for all kinds of valorized traits, but also anxieties and caricatures and all the rest. Just looking through that lens at sort of what the experience is of inhabiting that figure and having it sort of imposed upon you at the same time as you're also sort of potentially making sense of it for yourself in various ways. And there too being sort of vulnerable to misrecognition in certain ways.
You do bring it back home in the postscript. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of so-called resiliency?
Sure. Yeah. This is something that I'm actually continuing to work on now. That title for the postscript comes from some of the rhetoric that I saw being deployed to talk about the how it was that that folks at Fort Hood were carrying on in the wake of the 2009 mass shooting there, and I had wrapped up my fieldwork quite a more than a year before the shooting happened, though I did visit the base a couple times after it happened. One of the things I observed in just in sort of reading a lot of the media coverage about it was that there was there's this kind of broader irony that that this terrible and destructive and an incredibly violent and upsetting event that happened there and that truly did have a huge impact on folks in that community. And it was devastating. It was frightening. It was overwhelming to people. But it was nonetheless a little bit ironic that it took this rather rare and exceptional event to bring attention to the more kinds of chronic and ongoing kinds of burdens that had been placed on that community, not just by a single event, but by but by previous 10 years of routine work of war making. And one way that I saw this this irony taking especially acute form was in this idea of resiliency, which is something that it gets talked a lot about in psychology, but it's also a concept that that has a life in across a lot of different disciplines in systems analysis and science studies, in environmental science, all sorts of of different fields that many of which have very little to do with human behavior or human experience. But it's this general idea of the human capacity to sort of bounce back from adverse experiences, and it is, you know, in its way a pretty hopeful concept. But it's I think, as I say in the conclusion, the mechanisms that we live with in our society that organize violence and organize the distribution of harm, those mechanisms rely on the fact that human life is resilient. You know, that it's possible to discipline human bodies and subject them to harm and make objects and instruments of them in various ways and have them perform those functions. You know, that's life is resilient in that way, and the structures of power and harm that we live in the midst of really depend on that capacity, and so I was interested in the way that what I thought of as a really kind of a somewhat facile way of talking about the idea of resiliency in this context, in a way sort of serves as a distraction from those bigger dynamics of organized harm, because if we locate the ability to endure just in individual human bodies and human psyches, it kind of lets us off the hook of having to look at what sorts of organized structural conditions are in place making that harm, creating the conditions of possibility for that harm to begin with. And I'll just say that this is an issue that I think is especially important because the concept of resiliency is being increasingly and actively deployed by programs within the military as a way of trying to sort of preempt traumatic stress among service members. And there's a range of different programs. I think the largest one and the one that's received the most attention is the Army's program, which is called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. And the idea is that by engaging in this sort of proactive resiliency training, soldiers will be less prone to develop post-traumatic stress disorder in the wake of trying and traumatic experiences. And this program, like most resiliency training programs, has aspects to it that doubtless are helpful to quite a lot of people. A lot of kind of standard cognitive behavioral therapeutic psychoeducation kind of stuff. You know, how to think about your own stressors, how to sort of recognize your emotional reactions to them, and things like that. Again, things that that could potentially be quite useful and quite helpful to a lot of people. But the rhetoric of these kinds of interventions is something that at least in my interpretation, sort of depends on, as with the concept of resiliency more generally, sort of depends on moving responsibility for how bodies and minds respond to harm and respond to stressful circumstances, moving that responsibility from the structures that engender that harm in the first place onto the individuals that are impacted by it, and it's interesting to think about in that context sort of what we imagine the effects of war to be and how it is that we expect people exposed to those impacts, how it is that we expect them to behave, how we expect them to feel, especially, not least because that exposure is something that happens in our name and that we presumably bear some measure of responsibility for. So hence the the sort of jaundiced eye that I take toward the concept of resiliency in the conclusion.
Well, Ken, we've taken up a lot of your time, but we have one final question.
Sure.
What do you consider the most valuable contribution of this book to anthropology?
So in terms of, I guess I wouldn't want to make any claims about what I imagine the impact to be, but I think part of what I hope for it to be is to a certain extent sort of demystifying the world of the military and in some ways demystifying the practice of the organized practice of state violence in a kind of broader sense. Because these are topics and sort of subject areas that loom so large within the discipline, and to show, you know, I think one of the things that ethnography is really good at is one of its strengths is it's to focus on actual human practices. You know, looking at how mechanisms of power actually work, looking at how experiences of suffering actually are lived through, without resort to the kind of cliched narratives that we otherwise have on hand to make sense of those things, and the U.S. military certainly has more than its share of cliched narratives attached to it, from all sides and also from within, arguably, and those narratives are a big part of what kind of make it up and define it in the first place too. But I think being able to look at the actual production of war on this kind of intimate and banal human scale, I think is I hope is something that will help sort of further demystify and I'm not fond of the sound of this word, but just sort of further humanize it. And not just both sort of on behalf of the people who I write about in the book and whose stories I tell and whose experiences I hope are well represented and there in the course of the book, but also for the production of anthropological perspective on these issues more generally.
Well, we certainly think it's a very well-written and substantive book.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, we wish you luck in the future with your future research, and we really enjoyed talking to you today.
Yeah, likewise. So it was such a pleasure to talk with you guys.